Well, we're into the normal weeks, so you don't have to listen to me nearly as long as last time. But you do have to do some work. This is the first normal week because it's the first time you're going to be doing an activity, which in this case is actually an experiment. Also, notice, if you haven't already, that this is the first week for which you will have to do a report. Remember, there are three reports. This is the first one of them. It's not due today. It's due on the date that's already posted and that you should be aware of, and that I'm not. I don't have the due dates memorized, but it's up there. You're not writing the report in here. So all you need to do today is get your raw data, make sure everyone in the group has the raw data, and then you'll be done. But there's a few things I need to talk about before we do that. One is that I just simply need to introduce you to some basic scientific tools, just so you know the proper names of them. These things that are sitting out over here. What do we call this one?
Beaker.
That's a beaker, which is one way to contain volumes of liquid. What is this?
Flask.
It's an Erlenmeyer flask, or just a flask. Test tube holder. This is what?
Benson burner.
This is a Fischer burner, similar to a Bunsen burner, but it's a burner. You'll be using these one of the weeks. This is an example of a pipette. Pipettes are used to measure and dispense measured quantities of liquid. This is a graduated cylinder, also used to measure and dispense liquids. This thing is a magnetic stirrer and heater, so you can heat things in a beaker, for instance, but you can also put a magnet in there and stir it. This is a vortexer that you won't use today, but you'll eventually use these to mix the contents of tubes because it spins it. Just the opposite, in a sense, is this, which is a centrifuge. It doesn't mix things. It separates things that are already mixed by spinning them. This is a micropipetter. So there are bigger pipettes. This is one example of a pipette. There are bigger tubes as well that are still pipettes. Those are for macroscopic or comparatively large volumes. When you get to tiny volumes that you can't really measure by eye, you use a micropipetter with a tip. So when we finally get to use these, I'll explain them more in detail then, but that's what they are called. And this is a sparker with a bad flint in it, but they're supposed to spark to light the burner. All right, so those are the official names, in case you didn't already know any of those. I want to go over these important concepts for today, including careful liquid measurement. And that applies to today because you're doing the saltwater boiling experiment today, which involves liquid measurement. When you have any given liquid to measure the volume of, there's all kinds of choices you have to measure that volume with. For instance, you could use a beaker, because notice that a beaker does have graduations that are we have volumes listed on them. But that shouldn't be your go-to device to carefully measure liquids' volumes. That's just a very rough estimate. It is a cylinder, though, right? You use a cylinder to measure, to make careful measurements of liquid, but you use a much narrower diameter cylinder, like a graduated cylinder. Now, it's still a cylinder, it still has marks on it, but why is this graduated cylinder more accurate than this beaker? But why? What about the narrowness makes it more accurate? It actually makes it higher resolution, in addition to more accurate. What were you going to say?
I was going to say units are smaller.
Yeah, but just in general, you know, think about putting a volume of water onto a flat baking tray, right? It's just going to be not much of a layer of water spread out, right? And if you add another amount the same way, it's going to make it a little higher, but it's not going to be much of a change vertically. So it's going to be hard to detect that difference, right? But if you put the same volume into a narrow tube, it's going to go to a certain height. And then when you put the second volume in, that's going to drastically change the height. So you're going to be easily able to tell the difference in those measurements. That's why the narrower the diameter, the higher the resolution you have in measuring the liquid volume. That's why you should always use the smallest graduated cylinder that is large enough to do the job. Sometimes you're measuring pretty large volumes, and there are much bigger graduated cylinders than this one. Well, you could use a small one. You know, if you're measuring out, you want to measure exactly a liter, you could use this or even a smaller one. But if you did that, you'd have to make multiple different ones, right? And add all the volumes together, multiple different measurements. Well, each real measurement has some error associated with it. And therefore, if you have to make a lot of measurements, your errors can add up. So you use the smallest one that is big enough to do the particular job for you, and then you'll minimize your error. All right, that's careful liquid measurement. Now, this word meniscus, I think that was already part of your pre-lab, wasn't it? Okay. When you do put liquids into a narrow cylinder, you have a meniscus form usually, but in a graduated cylinder you have graduations, of course, that are the units. Ideally you would want to put a liquid in there and have the level, wherever it is, be nice and straight across the tube, right? But that's not what happens. Instead, you'll get a meniscus, which is a curvature. And there are two ways that can happen. You can have a negative meniscus, which is a downward curvature. And that's all you'll see in here, because that's what happens whenever water is part of the mixture. But if you were using mercury, for instance, which is liquid at room temperatures, it would have a positive meniscus, like in a barometer. You don't see them anymore because they don't want the mercury to be exposed to anyone, but a mercury in a tube will have a positive meniscus. Anyway, it doesn't matter whether it's a negative or a positive meniscus. A meniscus itself is ambiguous because it's not straight across, and therefore it doesn't match up to a single tick mark. If you imagine straightening it out so that it would be like this, the true value would be somewhere between there and there, right? But you don't really know by looking at it. Same way with a positive meniscus. There's a range of possibilities. You know that it's not either extent. You know it's somewhere in between exclusively. But how far between? That's why we don't really use the real value. Instead, we have a convention, which means in science we've agreed on this, how to do this, so that we're always doing it the same way. And the convention is that when you have a meniscus, you read it always as the middle part between the walls, where the middle of the curve is. So for a negative meniscus, it's always the bottom of it. For a positive meniscus, it's always the top of it. And whatever graduation that part marks up, matches up with, even though it's technically not right, that's what we call that measurement. Okay? Now, doing that is not possible unless you get your eye down at the level of the meniscus. For instance, if I draw a dot here, and then I put this marker up here, and I ask different people in this room, is this dot on the left side or the right side of this marker? Well, it depends on where your eye is coming from, right? There's different angles. That's known as parallax error. And you don't want to make that parallax error, but you will if you try to stand up and read a graduated cylinder that's down on the table. to get the true reading, you're going to have to put your eye exactly at the level of the meniscus so that it will match up properly. So bother to do that when you use a graduated cylinder. Okay, now we have four different definitions to get through quickly. These also apply to today because the liquids that we're using to boil, or the liquids that we are boiling, are solutions. Or at least, all but one of them is a solution. A solution in chemistry is one special kind of mixture. There's different kinds of mixtures in science. A solution is a mixture that's either, well, it's a fluid mixture, first of all. And what does fluid mean? Fluid, as a word, means able to flow. That's just an adjective. But as far as science is concerned, a fluid is a non-solid. A fluid can be either a gas or a liquid. They both flow. All right? We're using liquid fluids today, but it could be either. Anyway, a solution is a fluid mixture in which something is dissolved in something else. And the thing that is dissolved in the other thing, the thing that is being dissolved, is just part of the solution, and it's specifically called the solute. Now, you can have more than one kind of solute in the overall solution, but a solution has at least one solute. The solvent, which there can also be more than one of, but typically there's one, the solvent is the thing that dissolves the solute. And the overall solution is both of them combined, the solutes and the solvent. Now, often, and almost always, the solvent in biology, including for the solutions that are inside of cells of living organisms, is water. There are other kinds of solvents, but water is usually the solvent in biology. And in that case, in that particular case of water being the solvent, we say that the solution is an aqueous solution. Aqueous simply means water-based. But you can dissolve things in alcohol and other things as well. Okay, so water is the solvent today. What is the solute? Sodium chloride specifically. Because remember, there are many, many salts. And actually what happened, when I said that in a solution there is dissolving, when you have a salt that's being dissolved, which is an ionic compound as we talked about, when it gets dissolved, as we'll see in more detail upstairs the next time, you no longer really have the salt, which is the overall compound, sodium chloride, because the water molecules separate the ions and surround them individually. So really what you're having today is a solution with two solutes, sodium ions as a solute, and chloride ions as a solute. Now, we still call it salt water, but technically, once the dissolving has occurred, you don't have salt anymore. You have sodium ions and chloride ions in solution independently. Okay? All right, so that's the stuff you're using. What about molarity? Well, molarity is just one way of expressing something about a solution that is called concentration. There's multiple ways of expressing concentration, but the concentration of a solute refers to the relative amounts of the components, solute and solvent. You can also, in everyday terms, think of concentration as the strength of solution. You know, very strong salt water, if you use that term, would mean a high concentration, which means for a given volume, that there's a lot more salt in that volume than there would be in the same volume of a weaker solution, a lower concentrated solution. So concentration is how much solute there is in relative to solvent, but it can be expressed different ways. So there are different units for it. And molarity is just one way we can express it. That's the one, that's the expression of concentration we'll use in here. Molarity has units of molar, which is capital M by itself. Notice that this does not conflict with the metric system, in which M means mega, as you already know, because you never use mega by itself, right? So capital M does not mean mega by itself. Capital M means mega only if it comes before the abbreviation of a unit. Right. Capital M, lowercase m, megameters. But capital M by itself means molar, and that is an example of a derived unit. Concentrations are derived units because there are multiple units making them up. If you want to decompose this derived unit, molar, it would be, in terms of units, be made up of moles of solute, and MOL is the abbreviation for MOLE, moles of solute per liter of solution. All right? Now, you could also measure a concentration known as molal, which we don't use in here, but that would be moles of solute per kilogram of solvent. It's a different way of expressing it. They're both concentrations, though. Molar is what we use in here, though, and that's what you'll use in your report once you finally write it. Let me remind you, by the way, that the report, when you get around to writing it, a couple things about it is that you're sharing your data as a group. You're working as a table. So obviously everyone's going to have the same data. You share that. You do not share the work of writing the report. All the reports have to be written entirely by an individual, including the graphs. You know, you don't share your graph either. That would be plagiarism. That's what the rules consent form is all about. So keep that in mind. But that's molarity. Physical and chemical changes are next. These are both changes, obviously, but what is the difference between a physical and a chemical change? It has to do with the same use of the word chemical when I spoke about bonds today. A bond is a chemical bond only if you have new substance, right? Similarly, a chemical change is a chemical change only if, after that change, you have new substance. That's a chemical change occurs when a chemical reaction occurs. That doesn't always happen, though, for all changes. For instance, the evaporation of water, when you boil pure water, some of it's going to evaporate, right? That's a physical change. Because you have water molecules to begin with in liquid form. You have water molecules afterwards. They're still water. And by the way, this brings up the question of what actually distinguishes a liquid from a gas. What's the difference? They are the same substance. They're just two states of the same substance. Yeah.
Would it be like the speed of the water?
Not necessarily. The speed tells you the temperature. And it is true that temperature is kind of involved, but that's not actually the distinction. Anyone else? Yeah. Instead of connected, let's just say close, how close they are. It's all about spacing. In a solid, particles are very close to each other. There's space between them, but it's not nearly as much as it is in a gas. A liquid is a little less spaced, I mean a little bit more spaced, but still pretty close together. The difference between those two, by the way, is that the solid, even though the particles are individually moving, they're not trading places. So it's a chunk that has a specific shape. Even no matter what, you know, you put it into a container, it doesn't take the shape of the container. A solid doesn't. A liquid does. The spacing is close for both of them between particles, though. A gas is mostly space. So it's the same particles when a liquid evaporates into a gas. You have the same stuff. That's why it's a physical change. But they become much more spaced apart. And it doesn't make sense to talk about one molecule of a gas or a liquid. It has to be one of a population for it to be either a gas or a liquid, because a single water molecule in the gas phase is indistinguishable from a single molecule of ice or liquid water. This is what I was talking about earlier when I said about formula units. Molecules are predefined sizes. They can't get bigger than what they are. Okay, that's physical and chemical changes. Independent and dependent variables are variables, obviously, but let's just talk about variables in general, which are important in science, especially in experimental science, which is what you're doing today. A variable is anything that can vary, of course. Well, think back to the scientific method. Why do we, in general, conduct an experiment? What's the goal? Well, it's more specific than that. Yes, and to test a hypothesis, you're not really directly testing the hypothesis, right? The test is designed to directly test what? To test whether the corresponding prediction, the prediction that corresponds to a hypothesis, will come true. Right? And if it does come true, the hypothesis might be true. If it doesn't come true, the hypothesis is flawed. Or you've made a big error in the setup. All right? So that's what experimentation is all about. Well, there's, for any given experiment, there's a countless number of variables in the universe. Like, let me just say, for instance, to use it, one example of an experiment. If I were interested in testing what the effect of the concentration of a nutrient solution is on the growth rate of a plant, right? There's all kinds of variables that could affect my results because they can vary. But I don't want almost all of those variables to have any effect. So even though they are variable, I want, as the experimenter, to keep them from varying. And that's why those things are, because they have nothing to do with the experiment. I don't want them to interfere. And that's why those things are called controlled variables. Because you, as the experimenter, try to keep them from varying so that they're exactly the same for all of your different subjects that you're using in the experiment. Therefore, they don't have any effect. All right? But then there's two other kinds of variables, the ones that are listed up here, which are independent and dependent variables. And students get to get these mixed up. Typically, so let me give you a practical way to think about these. Their names make sense, and I usually define things linguistically, but I think in this case it's better to think practically about these two, by which I mean how they're used. The independent variable in any given experiment is the thing that you as the scientist adjust. So you allow it to have different values. You set those different values. All right? The thing you're adjusting is the independent variable. The dependent variable in any experiment is the thing that you as the scientist are measuring. And the whole reason you're going through this is because what you're trying to figure out is whether a change in what you do adjust, which is the independent variable, has any effect on the thing you're measuring, which is the dependent variable. Okay? And you can think about this in terms of mathematical functions, which you typically graph, right? This goes hand in hand with the fact that you typically graph results of scientific experiments. But a function like f equals x squared looks like this for the positive x's, right? What this shows you graphically is that the y value here does actually depend on the x value. If you change the x value, you're going to get a change in y. If you had a constant function, like f of x equals 3, that would have a graph like this. And it doesn't matter what you put in as x, which would be like your independent variable, you always have the same output, 3. So in that case, this is not dependent, y is not dependent on x. But in science, you're not dealing with functions, you're dealing with measurements of data. So the independent variable is always the thing you adjust, the dependent variable is always the thing you measure, and you could graph these on either x or y axis, but there's only one proper way to do that. Where does the independent variable go on a properly constructed scientific graph? Which axis? The x-axis, the horizontal axis, should always have your independent variable. The thing you measure, which is the output in a sense, just like y is the output of a function, always goes on the vertical axis, not the other way around. And in the example, this plant example I gave you, what is the independent variable? The concentration of the nutrient solution added, exactly. Because that's what I'm adjusting as the scientist, right? I'll give one subject a certain molarity of it, for instance, certain concentration. Another one a higher or lower. Each one's going to get a different concentration, okay? Now, by the way, notice that there's all kinds of things that could affect growth rate of plant. Those are the, but they don't have anything to do with what I'm asking. So those would be the controlled variables. I would want to make sure, for instance, by controlling those variables, that I use the same species of plant in each of the pots. I would want to make sure that they're all the same age to start with. I would want to make sure that they're in the same exact kind of pot. They have the same amount of sunlight, given the same amount of water. All kinds of things I can control, right? Those are controlled variables. The only thing that I'm going to change is the independent variable, which would be the concentration of the nutrient solution. And then what am I measuring? It's the dependent variable, but what is it in that example? The growth rate of the plant, yes, which I can measure in a lot of different ways, for instance, millimeters per week, right? But if you want to properly, well, let's, before I get to that, let me say that when you do graph data, first of all, you want to make sure you have the axes labeled properly. Don't put dependent variable down here and independent variable up here. That's switched. So for my example, it would be concentration, and I would write this out, of nutrient solution. That would still not be enough, though, because what do I mean by concentration? Usually, there are units associated with it. So if I were measuring it in molar, I would, in parentheses, put the units, capital M in that case. Yeah. Yes. What? So a 1 molar solution means, by the definition I gave you of molar right here, that in exactly 1 liter of that solution, you would have exactly 1 mole of the solute. So there would be Avogadro's number of particles of solute dissolved in an overall 1 liter exactly of solution.
And for 2 moles, you would do it as if you had 2 liters?
Well, if you had 2 moles and it's dissolved in twice as much volume, it would still be the same molar concentration, because there would still be 1 mole per liter. A 2 molar solution would have 2 moles dissolved in that same 1 liter. It's moles of solute per liter. I'm glad you asked that, because that's probably someone else was wondering that. Okay, so don't forget your units in parentheses. And you would label it accordingly. You don't label this, you never label this independent variable and this dependent variable. You actually say what it is. So for my plant example, what's the dependent variable? Growth rate, which also has units, let's say millimeters per week. Well, you go through with the experiment, you make actual measurements, right? There's only certain concentrations I'm going to be actually using in my experiment. Those are the ones that I set. I determine those concentrations in the experimental design. But they'll have some values. And for each one of those values, I'll make a corresponding measurement, right, of growth rate for that plant that got that concentration. And that's where the dots come from. And let's just say you have 4 measurements in simple case. Notice that those dots don't fall perfectly on a line or perfectly on a curve. And that's because they're real measurements. It doesn't mean that there isn't actually a linear relationship. These are somewhat close to a linear relationship, but they don't fall all on one line perfectly, right? And this will become more evident that's linear the more and more values of the independent variable you have, the more x's, in other words, because there will be more and more points. But even though they're not perfectly linear, because they're real measurements, there can be a linear trend. And this is what I want to get into on this last point, but before we leave proper graphing, this is not a complete graph, even if I had spelled these all out nicely, and first of all did it on graph paper rather than just blank. What's it lacking? A what? A title, and specifically a good title. Here's an example of a bad title. Bio 181. Which I see often. Or week 2, whatever. Those are terrible titles. They don't at all describe the experiment, right? So you would name it something like the effect of nutrient concentration on growth rate of this plant. Whatever it is. Give the title a descriptive. Give the graph a descriptive title. Okay, so title's up there, whatever it is. But anyway, back to this notion of this being what looks like a linear trend. If you are convinced that there seems to be a linear trend, then you can make what is called a line of best fit. And if you're doing this with a hand-drawn graph, it would be best to use a transparent ruler. Because if it's not transparent, you'll be covering some of the dots when you try to make a line through these. Now, a line of best fit does not necessarily go through any point. A line of best fit is called that because it is the single line that goes through, I mean, that gets as close as possible to as many as possible of the points. A computer will do this automatically, but you can do it with a ruler. And I'm just going to do a rough one right here. That's a fitted line. A line of best fit. Why is that important? Well, it makes the graph easier to look at and read. But it also, much more importantly, allows for prediction. These 4 data, And I say these because data is a plural word. It's the plural of datum. So it's the data are, not the data is. Anyway, these four data are the only ones that are truly measurements. I didn't actually measure anything else, right? So let's just say this is 1, 2, 3, and 4 for values of molar. What this means is that I only have real measurements for these four concentrations. But I might be interested in what the growth rate would be at some other concentration that I didn't measure. I can use a line of best fit to make a prediction. So it's more than just making it easier to look at. It is a predictive device, a line of best fit. And by the way, when you have a linear fit, if it's anything other than a horizontal line like I had drawn for that constant function, then there is dependence of what we call the dependent variable on the independent variable. That variable depends on what you adjust. And that's why it's called the dependent variable. But it's not necessarily dependent. If my dots were horizontal, then that means it does not actually depend on it. We would still call it the dependent variable in that case, because that's what we measured. But we're showing that it actually isn't dependent. This one is, though, because it's a non-zero slope. Okay. Well, once we draw this line of best fit, we can undergo either interpolation or extrapolation. These are both really the same exact technique, but we put them into two categories because one of them is much more safe scientifically than the other. What does inter mean? Between. And what does extra mean? Outside of, right? Like an extraterrestrial, outside of Terra or Earth. Interpolation gets its name because you use a line fit, you use a part of the line that is between values that you actually measure, between real data points. Okay? Like anything between 1 and 2, anything between 1 and 4 overall, because that's the whole range, that would be interpolation. If 1 is the smallest one I measured, then I could still use this line right here. But that would be extrapolation, and anything above 4 would be extrapolation because it's outside of the overall range of measurements. That is much more dangerous to assume the validity of the fitted line for. I'll show you why in a minute. But anyway, the actual use of the line, you can do mathematically, but you can also just do it graphically using rulers and graph paper. Let's say that I want to know what the value of growth rate will be for this particular value of concentration, somewhere between 2 and 3, whatever it is. What I would do graphically is go straight up from that point until I hit the line, and then straight across until I hit the y-axis, and then I would read that value from the y-axis. Right? That's predictive. Because I didn't actually do it, it's telling me what I would expect the growth rate to be if I were to actually measure or give it that concentration and then measure it. But it's interpolation specifically because it's between the overall range that I did measure. Extrapolation, you usually want to avoid. It's the same exact technique, right? I could say, okay, if it's 5, it must be right here. The reason why you can't be justified in that is because it might be linear for a certain range, but when you get too high a concentration, it might kill the plant. Right? So if you actually bother to do it at these higher ones, your data might look like this. It would collapse. And if you didn't know that and you just extrapolated this out to here, you would say, oh yeah, it's right here, when really it's down here. interpolation is much safer. Now,
really, technically, you only have 4 points here, so maybe the real response is like this.
And you don't know that either. But the more and more values of the independent variable you actually test, the more sure you are that it's actually linear if they all fall on that line. And that's why you do more than just the number of values that we're going to do in this experiment. But we don't have time to do all kinds of them. You would normally do quite a few, though. Okay, now, do I have anything else on this? No, good. That's the important points, but I want to just say, before I let you loose on doing this, which doesn't take very long, that there are ways you can mess up today. And you don't want to mess up, even though you've already gotten your points for the day in your quiz, because you have to write this up as a report, and it really sucks to have to write a report with terrible data, because you have to explain away things. It's just much easier to write a report if you've done things correctly. So even though this is very simple, all you're doing is boiling, there's a proper way to do it. What you have sitting out here, by the way, are your 4 solutions. Well, the 0 molar is technically not a solution. This is just pure water. 0 molar means no solute at all. So that's why there's no salt beaker behind it. But the 5 molar, the 3 molar, and the 1 molar are certainly solutions. And this just shows you, this is a liter of solution. This is actually the stuff you use, by the way. Make sure you're paying attention to which one you're using. They are clear, so pay attention to labels. But this volume contains actually this much. So this is 5 moles of salt. So that's a lot stronger than this one that has only 1 mole of it in the same volume. So don't mess with the beakers. They're just there to show you how much salt's actually in those. I don't clean up, and neither should the staff have to clean up very much. So this makes a mess, because you're not going to be able to do this without spilling anything. And it's salt, so when the water evaporates, it's going to be a salty mess. Just leave it as clean as it is now, and make it easier on them. Okay, now back to what you can do wrong. When you boil your solutions, which you can do in flasks, you want to... Well, let me just ask this. What is your dependent variable today?
Not a time to take boil?
No. No, you are not at all measuring time.
Okay.
And I get that a lot, so I'm glad you said that. So don't put that in your report. You're not measuring time. Yeah.
Temperature at which the water boils?
Yes, the temperature at which boiling of the solution occurs, which is also called the boiling point of the solution. Right? So you're not using clocks, you're using thermometers. But this is one source of error, at least for 3 of the 4 batches. For the pure water, the 0 molar solution, which is really just pure water, this is not a big deal. Because if you, and this is a graph of temperature versus time, which is not a graph that you're going to make, I'm just using this to show my point. If you heat up pure water and you keep measuring the temperature over time, the temperature is going to go up, right? With time. More seconds pass, the higher and higher the temperature gets. But only until it reaches the boiling point of water, which is not 100 degrees everywhere. Depends on the pressure. So don't expect yours to be 100. And don't write down 100. You have to write down what your measurement is, not what you think it should be. Anyway, when you hit boiling point, you can keep adding heat, but the temperature is not going to change anymore. It's going to plateau out. Because when it gets to the boiling point, all you're doing is transforming more and more liquid water into gaseous water, water vapor. And that keeps the temperature the same. So it wouldn't matter where you make that measurement. In other words, when it just starts to boil, where it's a full raging boil, or anything in between. But on the other solutions, it does matter. Which is why you have to, as a group, come up with a consensus as to what it means to boil. This is one of these controlled variables. You don't want to say, okay, boiling for this one is going to be just a simmer. For this one, it's going to be a full raging boil. That would be adding variables in there that you don't want to affect the outcome. So you have to think about how you're going to define boiling, which is the point at which you take the temperature. Agree on that. But it shouldn't be a full raging boil. And that's because if you have salt water instead of pure water, it will increase. But then when it hits a certain, when it hits boiling, what happens in boiling is that it's not salt and water that are turning from liquid to gas. It's only the water. The boiling point of the salt is much higher. This is what distillation is. You take advantage of different boiling points for different members of the solution. Yeah.
What does that mean?
That's why it matters. Because as you continue to boil a salt solution, you're taking away water that's evaporating as gas, and you're leaving behind the same amount of salt. So now you have the same number of moles of solute in less volume of solution, and the concentration goes up. You don't want the concentration to change, right? You want to measure the boiling point for that concentration, which means you need to get the temperature as soon as it starts boiling according to your definition. So it shouldn't be the very first bubble. That's not quite boiling yet. But as soon as it has a little bit of bubbling to it, that's what you should do for all of your four solutions. Is that clear? All right. Now, for safety's sake, when you're boiling these, you should use, let's say, 3 glass beads per flask. The glass beads are just little glass beads, but you don't have to use very many. Just 3 per flask. Drop them in there before you get your solution. Make sure you make notes as to, or label your flasks with the markers that you have, so that you don't get mixed up which solution is which. But put 3 of these in each one, and that's just to keep it from boiling out of control. Okay? As you heat it up, they'll start clinking, and it'll keep it from superheating, which can be dangerous because it can spill over the top. Anyway, when you're done with getting your temperature, which is what your raw data are, that's what you need to go home, you want to get rid of your solution down the drain or into this bucket. But you don't want to put glass beads down the drain or in the bucket. That's why you have
filter.
Yes. So just pour it through here, and I really shouldn't have to tell you this, but I'm going to anyway. If this bucket gets too full and it won't contain another group's volume, don't overflow it. Take this out, which will have some number of glass beads in it. Pour this in the sink so you can keep doing that. But eventually at the end, this should contain all the glass beads. We can save them and not put them down the drain. All right. Another thing you can make a mistake on is improper use of a thermometer. So your thermometers should be set to centigrade. Make sure they are Celsius, not Fahrenheit, if there is a choice. But when you put that probe in, first of all, it's not instantaneously going to be at the proper temperature, which is why you really want to keep it in there as it's boiling, so you don't have to have that lag time in the measurement. But you also do not want to have the tip of that touching glass, either on the bottom, especially the bottom, or the sides of the container. You want to have it fully under water or under liquid, but not touching any glass. Otherwise, you'll get an improper reading, and that will make your graph wrong and your answers wrong. Okay? I think that's pretty much what I wanted to say about it. Let me tell you one thing that some of you will do, unfortunately. When you have a independent variable, the different levels can be graphed differently depending on what kind of variable it is. First, for instance, if your variable is color, you could use red, purple, brown as your categories. That's a categorical axis that you would have. So you could put them in any order, and you could space them evenly just to make it look nice, right? But for a numerical axis, where they're actually numbers, then you shouldn't space them evenly unless they are numbers that are spaced evenly. What are your values for concentration today? 0, 1, I can't remember. 3 and 5? Okay, well, some of you are going to give me this. That's wrong, right? You'll never see a number line that shows 0, 1, 3, and 5 evenly spaced like that. Because they're not. So you need to properly space these on your axis. 3 and 5 are 2 units apart, whereas 0 and 1 are only 1. So if that spacing is wrong, then your fit is going to be wrong, right? So don't do that. The rest of it, though, is pretty straightforward when you get down to writing this up. It's just a matter of answering the questions that are on the instruction page for the saltwater report in the manual. Just keep in mind what I said last week. For all three reports, you're not handing these in hard copy, even if it says that in the manual. This manual was written by a different instructor for her section. Don't do that. You don't give me a hard copy. Has to be in Word. It has to be submitted via Canvas. The slot is already up there, and the due date is already up there. Okay. Also, though, you're going to have a graph that you do, and it's best if you do it by hand because you have to know how to make a graph by hand. That's a hint in this course for things that happen later. So you might as well do it by hand to get used to it. Anyway, to put that into the Word document, you have to take a picture of it and insert the picture into the document. You're uploading one document, not multiple things. So incorporate your pictures, however many there are, into the Word document, upload the Word. It won't take anything but Doc or DocX, by the way. So make sure it's that format. All right, I've said enough. Go ahead and do it. Get your data. And make sure, before leaving, that everyone in the group has all the data.